CataractCoach.com podcast series episode number 66 with Dr. Renato Ambrosio, understanding the spectrum of keratoconus and corneal ectasia.
Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. And today I have a very special guest. I have Professor Renato Ambrosio Jr. You've seen his name every week on my topographer. It says Ambrosio Index. So I know I've seen the name 1,000 times in my career. And now we're going to learn together from him about, of course, the cornea, keratoconus, but even more so, how this affects cataract surgery, refractive surgery, and more. So, Renato, welcome to our podcast, and thank you for doing this.
Uday, I'm honored. I'm very happy and grateful for participating in your program. Congratulations. It's kind of a dream come true because I always wish to participate because I listen to your videos. I learn a lot from your wisdom and how you teach, and your energy is so great. So I'm happy to be here.
Oh, thank you. Mostly I do cataract coach so I can learn, because I've never been the smartest guy in the room. So for me, it's amazing to be able to talk to such experts like you and learn. Now, when it comes to things like keratoconus, in my residency training, I learned very little. But you have done like a whole PhD in this.
Yeah. Actually, my interest on keratoconus was in my first year of residency. We learned doing topography and art exams in your colleagues. And I have an inferior stipending on my topography. So in the placido disc topography, it was the ICIS time. There was a silence in the room because I was just there with my chin and people were talking and how to move the joystick. And eventually they asked me, do you have anybody in your family with keratoconus or that had a transplant or something like that? They said, something is not correct. And This inferior stiffening was my interest in refractive surgery and also in keratoconus. Was what drove me to learn more about this. But I think we broke a lot of paradigms. We create some paradoxes. And I'm very happy to participate in this movement for is a true revolution in evolution.
So what should your average ophthalmologist like me, where I mostly do cataract surgery, that's most of what I do, what do I need to know about an irregular cornea shape or inferior steepening? What do I need to know?
Well, there are a few things. I think before going to the cataract domain, I think every human being in this planet should know that eye rubbing is bad. Eye rubbing is a very bad habit. So eye rubbing is definitely, there is a beautiful video from colleagues from India that they instead of saying like this, they say like this. Yes. That's how they say. So they were all changing their, getting this movement on the head. So that saying, don't rub your eye. And it was like maybe 4 or 5 years ago when we started the Violet June campaign. And so eye rubbing is very bad. And once you understand that eye rubbing is bad, maybe you can ask why is bad. I would say that while every human being should know that eye rubbing is very bad, any cornea surgeon should get some wisdom on the fact that eye rubbing may aggravate keratoconus or even cause ectasia. And those are not the same thing. And eventually it's hard to distinguish what is causing ectasia and eventually aggravating keratoconus because we still don't have a true genetic final test. Mm-hmm. But at the end, it's not one or the other. I evolved with this concept that's a little bit of susceptibility plus the environment. So both combined. So once you understand that eye rubbing is bad, you should talk about that to every patient. And eventually it's going to impact also allergy, going back dry eye, blepharitis. All of this can be related to eye rubbing, not eventually necessarily only keratoconus. But in the cataract domain, there are three main reasons for a refractive cataract surgeon to learn about keratoconus, because keratoconus would impact the IOL accuracy. So you need to find the best IOL formula so that you can have more chances for getting on the target. The second thing is that keratoconusa, irregular cornea, would affect the optics of the eye. So you need to learn about the optics so that you can eventually choose which IOL will best match for refractive outcome, for glasses independence, for the patient to be happy at the end of the day. And the third thing, which is probably the most important one, is because when you do refractive cataract surgery, you may need a corneal procedure as a secondary procedure. And if you have a susceptible cornea, you need to plan that in advance. And I have seen a handful of cases with ectasia after enhancements on the cornea after refractive cataract surgery, which is something that we have to be very aware of. And eventually it's going to be as important as ectasia after laser vision correction.
So I may have some genetic predisposition to have an irregular cornea. Let's say I have an uncle or someone in my family with keratoconus. So I may have a weak cornea to begin with. Then on top of that, I may have environmental issues like dry eye, allergy, blepharitis. And then, of course, the bad habit of eye rubbing on top of that, which all this together contributes to frank keratoconus.
Yes, it's a two-hit hypothesis. Every disease in that we deal with is related to environment and the basis of the genetic. And it's not only genetics, we have a lot of epigenetics and things that are related to the expression of genes, but it's not one or the other, it's both together, it's always both together. And that's why, for example, my friend Damien Gatinel, he says that eye rubbing is sine qua non for keratoconus. And I would definitely agree that eye rubbing, not only eye rubbing, but sleep over the eye, any pressure that you can induce against the eye will make the cornea weaker and eventually at a point that it can progress for biomechanical failure and ectasia progression. But there are cases that you just have little eye rubbing or no eye rubbing, just blinking, and you have ectasia progression. And we can get that on anamnesis when you ask the patient, are you rubbing the eye? And if I see a patient that is young with moderate to advanced keratoconus and he says, I'm not rubbing the eye, those are the ones with worse prognosis. Those are the ones that you have to cross-link as soon as possible, that you have to be more aggressive on the treatment, because these are the patients that may still need a corneal transplantation, which is something that we rarely do to them.
So if they're already in keratoconic shape without eye rubbing, that means their genetic predisposition is very high then.
Yes, we don't have a genetic test, and we don't have also an eye rubberometer so that we can quantify how much the patient pressures. And we talk to the patient, we learn about that, and some patients, the parents, they realize that they are rubbing during the night when they are asleep. And it's very effective to have them with some gloves, like boxing gloves. I have a few patients that use that wear those at night. And they cannot rub the eye, and it has to be very as smooth and with a good cushion for so that they don't get an angle for rubbing the eye. Eye rubbing is evil. Eye rubbing is evil, and we have to really promote the education. And the Violet June campaign was not only to promote this, it's to promote awareness, because patients should know about the disease, the possible treatments, and eventually live better with this condition.
So even if I have no genetic predisposition, no one in my family with keratoconus for 10 generations, but I am a crazy eye rubber and I rub the eyes every night, then I can still get keratoconus.
I have a few cases, and I would call those cases ectasia. And eventually, those are the cases that you may have this more eye rubbing and trauma for one eye, and then you have a very asymmetric ectasia, and the fellow eye may be completely abnormal in all the measurements.
The patient ends up having one eye more than the other.
Yes. So this is keratoconus is by definition a very asymmetric disease, and in some cases are very, very much asymmetric, so that they still have uncorrected good vision in the less affected eye. But as we have the concept that keratoconus is bilateral, ectasia may occur unilaterally, and ectasia can be also happening in both eyes. And that's when you have some misconception and it causes some confusion. The reason we have to distinguish, or we have to work on the understanding using multimodal imaging for understanding keratoconus and ectasia and differentiate both, is because of prognosis. So I talk a lot about diagnostics in ectasia. It's not the diagnosis of keratoconus. When you talk about diagnosis of ectasia, we are talking about screening, confirming the diagnosis, getting some classification and staging, and eventually doing prognostic understanding so that we can do an individualized treatment for the patient. And of course, follow-ups. All these are important in terms of diagnostics. And we have to go multimodal. We talk about topography,
right?
But sometimes think about placidosis topography, but we have like the Pentacam, the Scheinflug tomographers, and you have many of them available. Now we have OCTs coming and that are helping a lot. And this is truly multimodal, wavefront optics of the whole eye, biomechanics of the cornea, axial length, all of this data are placed into some algorithms that we have to use for getting the best of this information to help the patient in the best way as possible.
So what testing should I do for my routine corneal refractive surgery patient like LASIK, and also my premium or refractive IOL patient? So I should do a topography, like Placido disc, a tomography, dual Scheinflug. I should look at hyoid aberrations. I should look at OCT of the cornea. What do I need to do? Because I'm not a corneal expert like you. I just want to do cataract surgery, and I want to do corneal refractive surgery. So what should I look at?
You have to be aware of the technologies that you have available. Okay. I would say that you need topography with the Placido disc still, because it gives you information about the dry eye, about tear film, and tear film is very important for any procedure in ophthalmology, especially refractive cataract surgery, because this age population, they have a lot of dry eye. But I need tomography. I need a pachymetric map, and the pachymetric map will give us information about the thinnest point, the thickness profile, and those are the minimal data that I think it's necessary today. As much as I know, it's a little philosophical here, but as much as we know, the more we know that we need to know more. So today, I rely a lot on biomechanics, and I've done a lot of work with the Corvus ST, which is a Scheinflug dynamic system that you see the cornea deforming doing the non-contact tonometry. It's something that connects with the Pentacam so that we have AI for early detection of susceptibility. It's not the nomenclature form through keratoconus, subclinical keratoconus is kind of not easy because there is no consensus about it. I call those cases ectasia susceptible. And we evolved from detecting mild keratoconus in the Yaron Rabinowitz's great work on understanding the inferior stiffening, the asymmetry between the eyes, the skew of the regularity of the vectors on the astigmatism. But we evolved from detecting mild keratoconus to characterizing ectasia susceptibility, and also from Placido disc topography to Scheinflug tomography, biomechanics, and what we call multimodal diagnostics today.
So on the dual Scheinflug, on the tomography, are you mostly looking at bathymetry value, bathymetry mapping, or are you looking more at posterior float? What's important?
I look at both. I look at both. Honestly, both are important. And when people ask me what is the best parameter, we have to be a little nerd here and talk about ROC curves and statistics. I know that most of my colleagues, they don't like statistics, and they talk about statistics, they have a little resistance to go into this discussion. But it's I also didn't like statistics in medical school. I started liking it when I needed to understand diagnostics. So ROC curves, you can see the comparison of accuracy, sensitivity, and specificity. And looking at the value of each parameter, you can really look at this in an objective way in the ROC curve. So bathymetry is on the top of the main ones, but not the thinnest point only. You have the relation of thickness, which is how the cornea, it's thinner in the center and thicker in the periphery. So it gives you a metric on how it's evolving over time. I say that in the 3D, in the Scheinfeld tomography, in the 3D, you can imply what has happened and eventually do a prognostic evaluation what will happen. So both of them together will happen on. But elevation is very important. And I was very fortunate to work with Michael Bellin, who is one of the pioneers on elevation topography with a PAR system, which is only looking at the front surface of the cornea with elevation. It's a true elevation metric. And he used all his concepts for what Scheinfeld tomography when became available. And it was very interesting when we merged the idea of elevation plus bathymetry. And that's what we have in the Bellin Ambrosio.
So that's an important index. Tell me a little bit more about that.
So the BAD-D, it's not a good name. The BAD is very good. So the BAD, it says the nomenclature, the Bellin Ambrosio display, we have a final D. And this algorithm, we started looking at that in 2008, 2009. And at that time, we are starting a new work on AI. That time, AI was not so popular. Artificial intelligence was the very nerd thing. Nobody was talking about that. And we use linear regression. And linear regression is just a mathematical formula. It's very easy to understand. You have weights in different parameters for elevation, for curvature, and for actually curvature was not used. We just use elevation. And then we start using more and more about regularity and asphericity, which is very important. But we now use AI, and AI was very important for the Pentacamp with a random forest index that was not available in the software on the Pentacamp, only when you have the biomechanics integrated. And now the BAD-D V4 is coming. I hope by the end of the year, we have a very good algorithm that integrates some metrics on tomography related to the Zernike polynomials, especially coma and some other AI fancy work that we're able to train. It's interesting that you have to think about if you train to detect true keratoconus, you will be able to detect true keratoconus. But it's not enough. It's not enough. We need to go beyond that. We need to get the characterization of ectasia susceptibility. And the challenge is to define these groups. And the main group that we look at is the very asymmetric ectasia, so that one eye is a green topography, a normal topography based on the classic Rabinowitz, Kleiss, Maeda, and all the indices and the objective topometric indices, they are normal, and the fellow eye has a clinical keratoconus or clinical ectasia. And the challenge is that this is a diverse group, because some of these cases, as I said, they may be truly unilateral secondary ectasia, not the fellow eye with form through keratoconus, which is what we aim to do. So it's a continuum of susceptibility. Interestingly, it's working very nicely.
So it's a spectrum then, right? So it's not like a yes or no, keratoconus or no keratoconus. It's shades of gray.
Absolutely. I got this concept. I was inspired by Robert Weinreb from glaucoma, that he has a continuum on since the normality of the nerve until the very severe glaucoma. So it's a continuum. It's a continuum of disease. And I call it a continuum of ectasia susceptibility. And what we need to do, for example, when you do a laser vision correction is to integrate the relational impact of the surgery that you have and how much the cornea can eventually handle and be weakened and eventually be safe in the long term with the stability. So we have to combine. Some corneas may undergo, as you say, a thick flap and a minus 9-diopter myopic ablation, and some corneas made them undergo ectasia just blinking. And so it's a continuum. And the challenge is how to define this ectasia susceptibility objectively. And the integration with AI of tomography and biomechanics is merging with finite element models, which is the final understanding that we are evolving. It's like when you see in a parallel the IOL calculations. We have great work by Warren Hill, that gave the Charles Kelman lecture at Brasker's a couple weeks ago, and we have some other work by in Faco Optics, for example, and one is looking at the optics in ray tracing models. The other one is looking at a bunch of data and try to get some metrics from this very, very sophisticatedly trained. Both have to come to the same conclusion, but one is much more statistical based, AI based. The other one is more power, optical, physical based. And eventually they should go with the same conclusions. Like, they have to converge. And the beautiful thing is, when you look at both sides at the same time, that you can eventually understand what's going on in terms of ectasia susceptibility.
Now, what role does age play in this? Because if I see someone with maybe a superior inferior asymmetry and they're 25 years old, that's different compared to if the same patient is 75 years old.
It's a beautiful question, and I love this question because age is absolutely important. But age is either non-specific and neither non-sensitive. We have young patients that have strong corneas, and we have old patients with weak corneas. So age is important because there's the natural cross-linking over time. So I have seen a 45 years old with a very weak cornea, and I have seen 17s that are eventually with excellent structure of the cornea. So if you use age, you have a layer of, let's say, safety, because you are considering these cases that may evolve naturally to keratoconus. So you say no to those cases. But eventually, you are not specific to eventually help those patients with laser vision correction that can eventually have surgery when they are 25 or 27. Also, the problem is, if you think, okay, I'm playing very well with the age rule, you may have a 35 years old with ectasia susceptibility, and eventually those cases still exist. We still see ectasia happening after laser vision correction. Is getting rare and rare. The interesting thing about age is that when we look at age without biomechanics, age is very important. Mm-hmm. When you do feature selection, when we get the biomechanical data in, age is not important anymore. So it's beautiful to see that there is a correlation of biomechanical properties and age, but this correlation is definitely not the arrows. The R2 is not higher than 0.4. So we have a lot of scattering. So we have young corneas that are not weak and older corneas that are eventually very weak. So it's very, but age is very important. And the Randerman score, for example, definitely identified age. But if you have this age rule, eventually you have to obey that you cannot treat patients until they have certain age. And this is something that eventually may be not the best approach for some patients that need the surgery for some occupational and style lifestyle needs. And they may that benefit from laser vision correction.
So you have to tailor it then to the individual patient. You can't make like a hard and fast rule.
Absolutely. You have to individualize. The custom approach is for indicating which laser vision correction procedure. The custom approach is to how to plan the laser vision correction, how to program the laser using topography, wavefront, ray tracing. All this data can be integrated for enhancing safety and efficacy of surgery. So it's, and that's beautiful because we see that happening not only in the cornea level, but in phakic IOLs and in refractive cataract surgery.
So in my clinic, I do mostly cataract surgery. 80% of what I do is cataract surgery. That's why I'm at cataractcoach.com. Now, my question to you is, so I see a patient who's 70 years old, 65, 70, 75 years old, and I look at their corneas and they have an asymmetric bow tie. So let's say they have a with the rule astigmatism, but the superior part of that 90-degree meridian is 1 diopter steepening, the inferior is 2 diopter steepening. What do I do here? Do I still put a toric lens in? Do I try LRI? What do I do here?
Oh, the one that I would be very careful about is the LRI, because the LRI, the predictability, actually, this is a study that needs to be done. The predictability of limbal relax incisions, the stigmatic incisions, on the understanding of biomechanics and tomography. And this study is lacking. I think it's a huge potential for a breakthrough if we start planning LRIs based on tomography and biomechanics. But for toric IOLs, there are multimodal imaging. You know, what's the first measurement or the first data that you have with multimodal imaging? The first data is anamnesis, is a clinical history. So if the patient has gone through the whole life with glasses or soft toric contact lens, this astigmatism is kind of regular enough so that he has lived with his astigmatism with this type of regular treatment all his life. But when you see the Zernike in the center and the 4 millimeters that has low high order aberration, now you have to think about a toric IOL if the astigmatism is high. That's how I really look at in the cataract display on the Maeda is done by Nakayuki Maeda from Japan. There is a high order aberration of the whole cornea, front and back ray traced on the 4 millimeters. So it helps you to see this level of regularity.
That makes a lot of sense. So what I do exactly that. I look at a patient then and say, okay, what was your vision like 5 or 10 years ago? 10 years ago, you wore just glasses, which of course the glasses only correct lower order aberrations, sphere and cylinder. That's it. And with the glasses, you were 20/20 minus 10 years ago. So I think, hey, that's a good sign. That means a toric IOL will probably get you that same level of vision.
Yes, the patients that I would avoid doing a toric is when the patient has a gas berm or a scleral lens. Those are the ones you don't want to play with torics, because if you, I have seen a few cases like that. The patient after surgery, they have to get contact lens fit and glasses over that, because there was some residual astigmatism on the corneal irregularity, toric IOL, gas berm contact lens or rigid contact lens. There was astigmatism, the residual of that, and they have to get glasses on the top of contact lens.
Oh,
And they were really unhappy with those
that's
patients.
a very important point. So if a patient comes in with a lifetime history of 50 years of RGP contact lenses, and then you do the cataract surgery, if you put a toric IOL in the eye and the patient goes back to an RGP, now the RGP contact unmasks the toric IOL and you have to have glasses to correct the toric lens. So in a case like that, if they're going to go back to RGPs, no toric lenses.
Yes, there is a possibility for back toric contact lenses. They have
Right.
some fluorescence in the black back, and my wife fits those contact lenses, and she always gives me a hard time when that situation happens.
Yeah.
And usually, it's not my primary case, but you have to make a decision. And one thing I do in some of these cases is to think about the corneal procedure before cataract surgery, like putting a ring. Ring segment to regularize. And this is the going from the nomenclature of my friend Roberto Zaldívar from Argentina, is the therapeutic bioptics, is two corneal regularization. And then you can think about eventually a spherical or a toric IOL with a better refractive result.
No, yeah, I've great idea. I've had keratoconic patients that I did cataract surgery for. 70-year-old patient with keratoconus, not terrible, but worn RGP contacts for 50 years. In those patients, I always use a non-toric IOL, just a spherical IOL, and I always aim for a little bit of post-op myopia, -1, -2, and then I let them go back to the RGP contacts, and that makes them happy.
Yeah, sometimes the patient asks you, and especially when they are getting older, they get the fear. There is a very important and common fear that they are not going to be able to put the contacts anymore. They think about tremor. They are worried about that. And I think we have to be sensitive on finding ways to safely help these patients to get uncorrected vision. So it's a bioptic procedure. And it's not that it's forbidden to put a toric IOL, but you have to put that in the game. And eventually, I would say that this is a very good candidate for, we don't have this technology in Brazil, but the lenses that you can eventually change the optics after surgery in a very non-invasive way. And eventually the perfect lens that you have seen with a femtosecond laser and the other technologies that you have available may be a solution for those cases.
But right now, those adjustable IOLs only are for sphere and cylinder. You can't really adjust any higher order aberrations.
Yeah, but even the cylinder may be maybe good enough. But let's say, of course, we have all the pinhole optics. It may be beneficial for those cases, like the Trindade lens and the other lenses that we have for the pinhole. But we have to think about every case. You say beautifully that it's an individual procedure, and refractive cataract surgery is individualized surgery.
No, I think that's a very important point. Yeah, just to know the full spectrum. But it's interesting. I mean, the thing that I'm still thinking about from our conversation from the beginning is how you say that, like, how incredibly bad eye rubbing is. And I don't think we get this message across to patients. It's so common for us to see patients in our clinics who just rub their eyes, or little children who just rub their eyes all the time from allergies or dry eyes or whatever else.
Absolutely, yes. We have to teach people not to rub the eye, and that message has to be promoted. But I have seen, for example, ectasia progressing in adults after cataract surgery because they had dry eye after cataract surgery. And the dry eye caused them to rub the eye, and they have mild keratoconus that progress to advanced keratoconus. And eye rubbing is related to the progression of the disease for sure. Some corneas may progress with low eye rubbing, little eye rubbing, and some others may need more, but eye rubbing is so bad.
Yeah, if you think about it, these corneas are such amazing tissues. First, so thin, 500 or so microns thin in the middle. Clear living tissue that's clear and avascular. So it's like, it's an amazing tissue, but you're right. It's far more delicate than we think.
Yes. And we are very complex, but very perfect, I would say, even though I don't think perfect is a word that we have. We have to be careful in using it, but we have the perfection of the God, of the divinity. And if you think about how the cornea has evolved, how the endothelium is, the tear film is, and how thin is the cornea, we have to respect it, and we should not touch it with your bare hands, I would say. That's a good point.
Yeah, now I'm going to be very self-conscious from now on about touching my eyes, like very, very little.
Yeah, yeah. Let me ask you one question. What drove you to start the Cataract Coach program?
Well, you know, I love to learn. I love to learn, and I had a lot of good material on the internet. If you look carefully, you'll find surgical videos from me from 20 years ago. But about 7-8 years ago, I thought, you know, it'd be nice to have everything in one spot. So I said, let me make a website. And I said, I don't want to be like cataract professor. That sounds too stuffy and too old. Let me just do cataract coach, because even like the best tennis players, Roger Federer has a coach. Everyone who's the best always has a coach. So let's have a coach here then to learn to become better surgeons together. And then I decided maybe I should do one new video a week. Then I said, nah, let me do one a day. And I said, let me challenge myself. Can I make a new video every day? Well, 2,200 days later, the answer is yes, I can do it. And then maybe a year and a half ago, I said, you know what? I want to have a podcast. And the purpose of my podcast is I want to talk to some experts in ophthalmology, people who are much smarter than me. And let me see how much I can learn from them. And so that was the idea behind it.
That's beautiful. Yeah. I remember I had one of my visitors from Portugal, and he asked me, where did I learn a procedure? I don't remember which procedure was that. I think it was a cross-linking with a ring. It was something, but he asked me, where did you learn? It was in your fellowship. And I said, no, my fellowship, I only learned LASIK, PRK. That was what we were doing that time. But what I learned in my fellowship that drove me to do what I was doing is to learn how to learn.
Right.
The ways to learn how to teach and serve. And eventually I wrote a little poem about this. I'll send it to you. It's something that is connected, because learning is the best joy, because we are here to evolve in this planet. And the best way to evolve is to learn and to serve. And that's the beauty of what you were doing, because you were serving the hundreds, thousands of people that listen to your program. They truly can help many, many people after seeing you, after seeing your energy, how you talk to people, how you extract the best from whoever it is. So I'm very happy and honored to be part of this great group of people that you interview. I was really happy when you sent me an email. Thank you for that.
Oh, of course. Well, I'm here to learn. And I think we all learn together. And people are sometimes surprised when I say, I learn more from the Cataract Coach videos than I teach. It's mostly Cataract Coach is to benefit me. I learned so much, and by watching all these videos, by seeing these techniques, by speaking with experts like you, and then I love to share that. And then I tailor to the young generation of ophthalmologists, where they don't want to watch a very long lecture. They want one video a day, 5 minutes a day. So even I learned on YouTube, I have to show the important part of the surgery within 30 seconds. But if I put the same clip on Instagram, I have to show the good part within 3 seconds. Because on Instagram, if you don't show within 3 seconds, they swipe to the next one, done. So I've kind of learned who my audience is. And if we look at demographics, most of the people, ophthalmologists who listen to Cataract Coach, are in the age of 30 to 50. So a little bit young, certainly. 50, I'm older than 50, so younger than me. But there's still a surprising number of ophthalmologists who are in their 50s, 60s, and even 70s who still listen to this, who still want to learn more. So I think one of the commitments we have as ophthalmologists is we all commit to lifelong learning.
So. Every human being. And the joy of ophthalmology is that we have a beautiful profession. We treat people in the most important sensitive vision is the most important sensitive that we have. As humans, our brain is really focused on the vision aspect. So we are visual. We have vision and the joy of helping people with vision is tremendous. And our profession is always evolving. We have technology, we have knowledge, and we have people like you that are always engaging people and these meetings, all this. And I'm very blessed and honored and happy for being an ophthalmologist.
Oh, for sure. I wake up every morning and think, thank you. I'm so blessed to be an ophthalmologist. How did I get so lucky in my life? It's amazing.
I remember when I met your son and he's starting medical school, and it's beautiful. So you really want them to be an ophthalmologist, and And you have a daughter, I remember, and she's not going to oncology, right?
So my best advice for my kids is follow your own heart, follow your passions. If you like ophthalmology, wow, what a blessing. I'll teach you everything I know. If you like something else, then follow that. You know, my father and my mother are both doctors. Neither of them did ophthalmology. And so when I started medical school, I didn't know I'd do ophthalmology either. It was just in my last year of medical school where I saw a patient with a white cataract having cataract surgery, and I thought it was a miracle. This patient had bilateral white cataracts. She had seen nothing for 5 years. And she has a surgery, a beautiful, elegant cataract surgery. And the next morning, she has normal vision. I literally thought it was a miracle. It was amazing. And so I said, wow, I want to do ophthalmology. And that's the day I fell in love with cataract surgery.
Nice.
Yeah.
Both of my father and mother, my mom is still an ophthalmologist. My father passed away 30 years ago. But I had this big drive from my family to be an ophthalmologist. But I didn't want to be an ophthalmologist. Actually, maybe my best compliment for medical school, let's say, was one of my intern medicine doctors, professors, that said, if I would be an ophthalmologist, it was going to be a waste for medicine. He said that. And he was always joking about that. He was not going to be an ophthalmologist, right? And he liked to talk about clinical cases, to learn. Internal medicine is fascinating when you start learning about it. But once I realized that ophthalmology is not that boring thing, one or two that I saw a few times
right
in the office, I really fell in love with that. And it's a blast. So like you, I want my daughters to be happy and to succeed in their lives, whatever they want to do. But if I have a wish, I want to want. My wish is to want, because 15 years from now, when 12 or 15 years, if I will want, if they are able to do it, if they like it, and especially if ophthalmology is still going to be a good profession, which is something that I have some questions, but I am very optimistic that it's still going to be even better because technology is evolving.
I agree. Listen, ophthalmology will always be important. Why? No matter what, in the history of mankind, our number one sense has always been vision. In the future, it'll be the same thing. It's your number one sense. The number one way you interact with your world is going to be visual. So ophthalmology, I think, is always going to be such a critically important thing. And in the USA, we train so few ophthalmologists. For many, many years, we only trained about 460 ophthalmologists per year for the whole USA, which is 360 million population. Now we've increased that number to a little bit more than 500, but still it's 500 something ophthalmologists trained per year for a population of 360 million. So we don't train a whole lot of ophthalmologists for the USA.
Interesting. Yeah, it's always a debate on how important you have to be a doctor or for truly doing what the eye care. So I think about the ecosystem. So eventually AI and some other tools may come into play. That's why I have some question marks in my mind if ophthalmology will still be a good profession. That eye care and vision will be important for humankind, there is no question about it. But if ophthalmology will be a good profession for a young adult to go for, it's the point. But it's all about that concept that AI is not going to replace us. I do a lot of work with AI, and I have a lot of interest in developing AI systems. But AI may replace the doctors that don't use AI, that's going to be a disadvantage. So they have to learn to adapt. And all these programs that you are doing, we will see more and more information about AI. And AI is definitely the momentum. And getting this momentum is a good opportunity, sometimes a challenge. And we have a lot of misconceptions that we have to evolve, because it's not to replace the doctor, but to empower the doctor.
Right.
It's something to help your clinical decision, not to replace your judgment.
Well, I agree with you 100%. And I'm involved in two projects now in ophthalmology that involve AI. Number one is, in February of this year, we were granted U.S. patents for our methods of doing lens calculations for cataract surgery and other, let's say, keratorefractive, lenticular refractive surgery using AI for the calculations of lens power. Now, again, that doesn't take away the human. It just makes you a better, more accurate surgeon. The second one is robotic cataract surgery, which is coming for sure. Now, the robot will be very adept at doing the basic cataract, 90% the routine cases, but not so good at the very challenging small pupils, synechiae, dense cataract, et cetera. That's just going to need to be done by the human. But it's nothing to be afraid of, because I'll give you an example. You know, we have LASIK today is 90% robotic or automated. When I put the suction ring on the eye for the femtosecond laser, and the femtosecond laser in like 15 seconds makes a LASIK flap, what do I do then? I lift the flap, I go to the excimer laser, which has a tracker at 400 or 500 hertz. It does the ablation, tracking the eye, being very accurate. What do I do next? I put the flap down. So 90% of the surgery for LASIK has already been done in a robotic sense, if you will. Cataract surgery is going to go the same way. When I flew home yesterday, I was in Europe yesterday. I flew home yesterday. The airplane I was on had autopilot, but it still needs the actual human pilots. And I think that's the way we're going to have it in cataract surgery.
Yeah, it's a good point. We have to be very careful with how we frame this, because how you lift the flap, how you put the flap back, how you center the eye, so that all this technology that is definitely automated, but the technology needs you to do a lot of things, a lot of little things. And there are small details which makes many of the details can make a huge difference. And the value of your experience and technique is going to be there. And one of the things is that PRK, for example, a lot of people believe that PRK is just center the eye, put the speculum, and then hit the laser, because even you don't need to scrape, because the laser is being removed. I do epithelial removal with a PTK since 2008. It's my preference technique. And now we have epi, many, many names for branding. But we have to do careful patient selection. We have to do empathic treatment on the patient, set expectations. We have to do patient care post-op, you know, the care of the contact lens. All of these are human-related abilities that eventually AI is not going to replace us. But it's beautiful when you say that cataract surgery with robotics. And one of the things I think, I saw some of the lung surgery with the Da Vinci, with the robot. The guy inside of the machine, he is movement a lot, and inside of the thorax there is small movement. Mm-hmm. So it filters all the movement. And so my question, so that's a huge advantage. My question is that if we need good surgeons for the challenging cases, and the challenging cases will still exist, we have to be thoughtful on how to train these good surgeons, because if the regular cases are going to be done by the machine, how is the surgeon going to have experience and hands-on? So I think a lot of the simulators, a lot of the models of the eye, all of these machines, all of these possibilities will be very important for the training of the surgeon. And experimental surgery will be definitely one of the most important areas for the regular residency training.
Oh, I totally agree with you. One thing that needs to happen is I think we need to go back to the era of merit. So in the USA right now, it's a very strange place. In the academic world in the USA today, they're valuing, let's say, checkboxes over merit. So there's some social engineering in choosing the appropriate candidates for medicine, whatever it may be, and they're not necessarily doing it based on merit. And that, I think, is going to be a big issue in the future. And so I think we need to go back to that. Like when I flew here from Europe yesterday, I flew home. The only thing I care about the pilot is how good was this pilot at all the flying experiences, at the flight simulators and taking the tests. I just want the best pilot. And the other factors, social factors, whatever other, it doesn't really matter to me. I want the skill. So I think we need to go back to that for medicine, for surgery, and say, hey, who are the people who are just, again, very skilled, either naturally or willing to put in the very hard work to achieve that?
It's all about training. I think there is a good book called Grit. Grit. So right. They have an equation from Angela Duckworth. And the equation is that if you have talent, with your effort, you develop faster your skills.
Right.
And once you have skills, you need to get effort again so that you have a result. The interesting thing, I love this equation. But this equation, she says that effort counts twice. But it's not twice. It's on square level. And 2 by 2 is 4.
Right.
3 squared is 9. And If you go higher the number, the higher the number, the larger is the difference between the double and the square. But what the point is that you have to do a lot of work. You have to train, and effort is going to count tremendous for this individual. So I would say if I have to choose between one surgeon and the other, I would say how much effort he's willing to put and he has put so that he can develop. And some surgeons are more talented, some surgeons are less talented, but at the end of the day, what is going to be most important is how you are willing to put your effort to learn. And this is a willpower. It's not it's definitely the most important drive.
Absolutely. Hard work wins every single time. Absolutely. I totally agree with you. So, I mean, you see it in the residents. The resident who's going to do the best in life is the resident who tries to learn from every case, who comes there with the USB thumb drive, videos every surgery, goes home and watches every surgery. At the end of the surgery, says, Professor, what can I do to be better? I need to be better every case. So the resident who wants to learn from every case, she will be the best. Whereas the resident who says, it was a good case, I'll try another one tomorrow, and doesn't put in the same effort, he will not be as good. Absolutely, you're right.
Yeah. And the more you have to train, especially in this new era, let's have a machine that is going to do FACO with a very standardized way, with all this fluidic control, everything. The residents, they need to learn how to handle when there's a problem. And the simulators, somehow they're going to be developed. Those will be time work. It's like going to the gym. If you like, you have to be like a mindset of an Olympic athlete. You need to go there X hours every day and eventually hit this. And that's how it's going to evolve. And eventually it's going to be beautiful because the quality of the level of the service is going to be higher and higher. And I'm optimistic that ophthalmology will be even better than it is today very soon. We are through this revolution and evolution.
Oh, for sure. And I think the young generation of ophthalmologists has an advantage. And that advantage is, they say, a smart surgeon learns from his or her mistakes. But a brilliant surgeon can learn from the mistakes of others. And it's this new generation now who can watch a surgical video and learn from that complication and then prevent that from happening. I showed a video on Cataract Coach of a phaco wound burn. And what happened in the case was the surgeon had a blocked phaco tip. So when the surgeon went to do phaco, you got the smoke sign at the tip of the phaco probe. Looked like smoke because none of the particles were being aspirated. So that surgeon got a wound burn. But I had a video sent in a week later from a young resident who said, I saw that video and look, I had the same thing happen. I started to do phaco. I saw the smoke sign of the tip and I knew because I just watched the Cataract Coach video come out of the eye. And yes, the phaco tip was blocked. Clear the blockage, went back in the eye. Beautiful routine case. His patient or her patient got saved and had a beautiful outcome because that resident learned from the mistake of others. And that's the power of this 5-minute video a day.
Beautiful. I love this story. I love this story. Congratulations.
Right. So the next generation of ophthalmologists, they can be so much better than me. Oh my gosh. They can be amazing because they'll learn even faster. They'll get better and better and get up the learning curve faster than I ever did.
Yeah. And in our time, I remember when the internet was not cable, it was just, you have to wait until midnight so that you can call internet with modem. And there was that sound that when you hear it, everybody knows what it is. If you have more, they say, if you learn, if you know what the sound is, you need to check your prostate. That's the joke. But the idea is
if you use dial-up internet, you're probably over age 50.
Yeah. So it's interesting that we have to take it. It's interesting because I'm from Brazil, so English is not my first language. But there is an expression to take things as granted instead of evolving to take things for granted. Mm-hmm. So you have to evolve to not to have it as a warranty thing, not to be entitled of something, so that we evolve into appreciation, and that you have to be humble, and there's a lot of wisdom there. And some of the younger generations, I would say, they need to realize that, and eventually, once they have this understanding, they will take advantage of all this beauty of the technology because they learn much faster. My daughters, they were born with an iPad, with something. Some of the movements I learned with them, there was always a message coming in, and they were like this just to take it out. And I never knew that. And I said, oh, no, this little baby knows this, and I never saw that way of them. So it's very intuitive for them. So it's a beautiful thing. And the process of teaching makes us really in a beautiful spot to serve. It's a realization of the value that you have. So your wound burn prevention is beautiful. I have a case very recently that a colleague of mine, he sent a topography, it's a tomography with a Bell and Ambrosio that's a yellow. And he asked me, what should I do? And I said, you need more data. And said, oh, but I don't think I should do surgery in this case. This is just a contraindication. I said, no, I think you may need more data, but I'm feared. And I said, okay, you're feared, but you're feared to do surgery because of this. I think you should be feared to do surgery without the information. Once you have more information, you have the courage. And that's a very interesting understanding, that the more you are prepared, the less fear you have. And that's part of the evolving process. But you have to be humble, because sometimes you know, and I think you know everything, and all these concepts, you have to be open to get a new piece of information and a new skill and a new development so that you can evolve. So you need to be wise and humble for that.
That is so true. I think for all of us, when we learn something new, when we learn, let's say, cataract surgery, after 500 surgeries, we think we know everything. But then after 5,000 surgeries, you realize how little you actually know. And then somewhere when you do 50,000 surgeries, you think, okay, maybe now I'm learning a little bit. But at the beginning, I think we all get fooled.
Yeah, this trap there is a good line from Neil deGrasse Tyson. He says, some people, they have a little knowledge to think they are right, but not enough to know they are wrong.
Oh, that's brilliant.
So I love this passage because that's exactly what happened when I developed my first tomography and biomechanical index. We had an algorithm that was very nice, random forest, beautiful, leave one out, which is a very sophisticated way to train, that you train for every case, leaving one out, and then you apply. And you do that for all the cases. And then you do some evaluation of all the models and eventually find one model that fits to all of them. And once you realize the algorithm that you, the pieces that you're going to put in your forests. So I thought, now I have something that I'm changing this. And many reports of lower accuracy on the normal topography eyes of patients with ectasia in the fellow eye. So I think I knew a little bit to think I was right, but not enough to know I was wrong. And then I got the concept of reinforced learning. So we have more data, more training, more AI, more algorithm, and then we got better. And I know we have to be still on the path to collect more data, train more, improve it. It's a continuous learning. But once you understand you are in a continuous learning, you also have to understand that you're already good. And sometimes I think about self-compassion. Because in medicine, we are sometimes too hard with ourselves. We want to be perfect, and we are not perfect. And that's the paradox. And optimization is the answer for that, because the paradox of perfection is that we know that we are not going to be perfect. And second, you need to go for it. So it's like chasing something that you never find, but you need to enjoy this path. And the way to do that is to continue optimize, to improve, to try to get better. And that's how you do it. It's learning, talking, getting more information, processing it, and again, getting this applied so that you can make some difference in the way you treat your patients, the way you train your resident. And all of this is going to be a process of enjoying life.
Oh, that's so brilliant. Ophthalmology truly is the field where it takes many years to learn it, but it takes a lifetime to master it. That's the big challenge. But wow, what brilliant advice. Renato, I want to thank you. What a brilliant time talking to you. I learned, as usual, so much. I really appreciate you being on our podcast. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. My honor. Thank you for having me. I'm always listening to you, and I'm inspired by you. I may start challenging myself to post, not every day, but one case a week. I want to post one case a week with a challenging situation on ectasia, on refractive surgery, refractive cataract surgery, and eventually all these cases will be collected in a big encyclopedia of challenging situations so that we can all learn all the time and eventually have some discussions. You were inspiring me. Thank you very much for that.
Oh, for sure. Well, send me a video and we'll feature it on Cataract Coach the day after this podcast airs. So we'll feature them together.
I'll send you a video that was awarded in Braskers. It's a black box thinking concept. The only ectasia case that I had, and I learned looking back on the data, and eventually so obvious today, why should I did a smile in that case? But I should have done a fake IOL. But you have to learn and be humble to admit that we have to learn and eventually try to use this experience, as you beautifully said, to help people prevent from having the same problem.
Fantastic. Well, yeah, send me the video. We're happy to feature it. And remember, for all the ophthalmologists out there, tell all your patients, no eye rubbing. Right?
Thank you. Happy Violet June.
Thank you, my friend. And I want to remind our listeners and our viewers, remember, there's a new Cataract Coach podcast every single week. You can hear it on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google, YouTube, anywhere you find your podcast. Plus, every day, we still have a cataractcoach.com video. Check it out, and we will catch all of you next time.